Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is biologist Megan Brown. Brown is a graduate of both the University of Michigan and the University of Minnesota, where she received her PhD in water resources science. She is currently an assistant professor of biology at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. She is both an educator and research scientist and has done research on the aquatic life as well as the effect of non-native species on the health of some of our local and regional Finger Lakes. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, I want to begin with the fact that you were brought up on the shores of Lake Michigan, fished with your grandfather, and you say that this influenced your academic path. Tell us.
Yeah, I think when I reached back to my childhood, most of my fondest memories involve the lake shore, being on the water in some way. And I didn't find my academic path until pretty late into my undergraduate education, and it was sort of like the ta-da moment of course, these things were in my backyard my entire life. And so in retrospect, I look back on them and know they influenced me, but as a child, it was more of a, you know, fun backyard to play in.
Well, you say in your biography that as a kid, you observed how the lakes were changing and, mm-hmm. and you would see dead fish in the spring. So,
yeah.
So that somehow got into your head that you wanted to do that kind of research, which fascinates me.
It did. You know, over the course of my childhood, Lake Michigan experienced the zebra mussel invasion, and alewives were very common to come in these sort of mass die-offs. And
explain that.
Yeah, so they're also a non-native species. Is something that's actually been in the Great Lake for some time, but the way their population dynamics work, occasionally there's a whole pulse of them that would wash up onto shore. And so those memories, as well as the very beautiful memories of lakes, definitely tied into what I ended up doing in my scholarship. So now I sort of seek out the answers to those things and why is it that they're able to establish far from their evolutionary homes and how is it that they impact our native communities.
Yeah, that's amazing how much of an observer you were early on. That's a great attribute for a scientist.
Well, perhaps that is what scientists do in their childhoods. They're very casually observing the natural world. And then we learned to refine that in our school.
Well, so how did you get into the exotic species study and non-native invasions? And how did you segue into that?
Well, as an undergraduate, I ended up working in the laboratory of a professor who was interested in plankton, which are these tiny organisms that sort of move things from the base of the food web up into the fish. And then the one in particular I ended up working in was one that was non-native. And we were interested in learning how it was interfacing with the native fish and native plankton. And so very early in my career, I began to ask questions about the role in which these non-native species influence the communities where they make their new homes.
How do you actually do research on this?
Well, it's a multifaceted project. You know, some of it involves being out in the lake. Some of it involves doing lots of work in the laboratory, be that looking at collections that we've taken from the lake or setting up experiments to look at the ways in which organisms react when we isolate variables in the laboratory. Some of it involves mathematical modeling, taking the biology out altogether and saying, okay, if you have a predator and a prey and these suite of variables, what happens as you begin to manipulate those? So it's definitely something that I've done just a little bit of everything on.
Wow, I wouldn't have thought of mathematics as part of the equation.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's that, you know, your junior high school teacher probably told you math would come back at you, and it does.
And did you find that a struggle for yourself, or did that come naturally as well?
I think the math and science came quite naturally to me. One thing I tell my students is I didn't realize how much I'd write. Uh-huh. And that's something that, as a professional, I just keep evolving as a writer, never reaching that peak that you want to get to. You know, you become accomplished in your science, you become accomplished in, let's say, the math that you're doing to analyze it. But the writing is always something I find I'm tweaking and working on.
That's something a lot of people don't think about, that you really have to have all these disciplines.
Absolutely.
Communication with what you find
Absolutely.
Is paramount.
Yeah. And I think in dealing with water in particular, particular, I've found that all of those disciplines just sort of flow together. You can't understand a lake without understanding the chemistry of it. You can't understand it without understanding the physics of it. And so I've certainly found myself in a career where one discipline doesn't cut it. You really have to have a good understanding of the way in which all of those sciences and non-sciences work together.
Uh-huh. How do you do research on history of lakes?
Excellent question. Yeah, we often find ourselves as limnologists, those of us who study freshwater, in a situation where we have data from the modern period but not the historical period. Mm-hmm. For example, in the Finger Lakes, we might be curious about how the lakes have changed over the last century or more. And that's a tough question to answer since there weren't a whole lot of limnologists studying the lakes very regularly. We have some nice studies that happen periodically, but no constant measure of how the lake is doing. And so one technique we use is to actually use the lake to tell its story. Every season, whatever is produced in the lake or happens to fall in the lake will eventually settle to the lake floor. And that happens year after year after year. So in effect, there's a big pile at the bottom of a lake, like a book, that is sort of the chapters of that lake. And so we can use fairly specialized equipment to go down to the lake bottom and take a core, take a cylinder of that history and bring it to the surface and basically cut it up like you would a cake.
It sounds like a tree trunk, too.
Exactly. If you were to core into a tree and pull that out, you could go back and age that tree and look at how conditions might have changed over the course of that tree's lifetime.
Wow, that's fascinating to me. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the research that you have done on the Finger Lakes.
Great.
Could you tell us a little bit about what you're looking for, what you found?
Yeah, so I'm newer to the Finger Lakes. It's just been the last 5 years or so that I've been working in these systems. But some of the projects we are interested in looking at are how, as I was just describing, the last century, what that has looked like for, say, Seneca Lake or Owasco Lake, and going back through those core records and understanding the productivity of the system, the types of species that were present. We can actually go into those sediments and find subfossils, find little tiny skeletons that were left behind and tell what species were here, how big they were, what they might have been eating or what might have been eating them.
Can you tell when they died off?
We can. We actually use different techniques, depending on the age of the sediment, to say exactly how old that layer is that you're looking at. So we use lead or cesium to do that. So this is another example of that chemistry coming right back in. In order to get the biological data that you're interested in, you've got to be able to run the analyses to look at how old the sediment is. Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect of my work here on the Finger Lakes. I'm also interested in the modern period and what is happening in the lakes at this very time.
Well, what is happening? I mean, we have found non-native species, obviously.
We certainly have a lot of them. In fact, just this past summer, we found yet another, the bloody red shrimp, which has made its home in Seneca Lake, which has a name that, like many invasive species, gives you a pause. I don't think I want that in my lake. And so being in the field of invasive species, you are kind of in this position where a new one comes in, which you feel badly for the lake or wonder what its ecological impact will be. But at the same time, it gives you an opportunity to study that system. What are the roles of predation and competition that may impact that organism's ability to survive?
Do we know how these get into the lakes?
We do. They come in a variety of ways. Most of the invasive species in the Finger Lakes have sort of secondarily invaded from the Great Lakes. Ah. So they come into the Great Lakes for the most part in the ballast of these large ocean tankers that are moving goods from places in Europe and Asia to North America, and with them are many hitchhikers in that ballast water. And then they move from the Great Lakes down into the Finger Lakes by recreational boaters, by bird migrations, by the canal system. And they find a very similar system in the Finger Lakes that they do in the Great Lakes.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. So are we finding that the finger legs are becoming less healthy because of these things?
That's a question I'm often asked, you know, are the legs healthy or are they healthier than they were? And even for someone in my field, I think that's a very difficult question to answer. Mm-hmm. I can say that the legs are functional. You know, there's fish in the lakes for people to, you know.
And people are swimming.
People are swimming, exactly. The lakes are certainly very different than they would have been had you looked at them or swam in them or sampled them. Say the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. So I think that's less of a question for a scientist and more of a question for us as a community to answer. Are the lakes of the health that we would like? Yeah. I personally can say no to that question, that many of the Finger Lakes are experiencing problems with water quality. They're more productive than we'd like them to be. The fishery may not be as healthy as we'd like them to be. But again, it's a difficult question to answer with a single yes or no response.
Yeah, I know somebody who was brought up here, and she came back after 30 years, and she noticed how dirty the lake seemed mm-hmm. from her childhood.
Yeah.
So I think the community does need to have that conversation.
Yeah, and it's a good conversation for me as a scientist to have community members, because we all see the world through our own eyes, and being here for a relatively brief period of time, I don't know what the lakes looked like in uh-huh. the 1970s or, uh-huh. say, in 1910. And
yeah,
so we
right.
use all those tools, both science and non-science, to understand where the lake is at.
Well, how much do human interactions affect the lakes? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I read some time ago that there isn't a water system on Earth that hasn't been impacted by humans.
Yeah.
You know, we learn
yeah.
about this water cycle where water moves very quickly in some cases from one location to another. And so whether it be the poles or the tropics or here in the Finger Lakes, all of that water is impacted by the human experience.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
our fingerprints are there.
We just had that in the Gulf of Mexico with that oil spill.
Yes.
That's one of the most
yes.
tragic examples.
Yes, yeah, and you can think of many others. So no doubt that the human influence is a big one on a global scale, and certainly here in the Finger Lakes, where we have fairly sizable populations living right around the lakeshore, those intakes and inputs to the lake system impact it in a strong way.
Yeah, yeah. Now you were also a visiting scientist in Italy for a time.
I was.
Could you tell us what you were studying?
Sure, yeah. Last time, at this very time of year, actually, I was living on Lago Maggiore, which is a long, narrow, deep lake in the north of Italy. And I was interested in actually using some of those techniques to look at the history of that lake, because it is home to one of our non-native species. So a species that's only lived here for about a decade has lived there on the order of centuries. So
wow.
we could go back in time in that lake and understand over the very long term what that species has, how it has lived its life in its native habitat.
Mm-hmm.
So Italy wasn't a bad place to do that. I'm sure I could have picked another location, but it was a lovely spot to study. And that's a lake, actually, that has been studied very regularly for a long, long period of time. There have been limnologists studying that lake every year. So it provided an appropriate setting to go study, but also one that had a rich history to combine with that.
So some of the native species that you saw in Italy are invading some of our lakes.
That's right. This one in particular, Italy probably isn't on the top of the list of a location that is a donor of non-native species to us. Probably the Eurasian area and the Ponto-Caspian area is probably the one that would be at the top of the list.
Mm.
But certainly there are species throughout Europe that have made their way here. And vice versa. There are a whole suite of North American species that we hold near and dear to our hearts that cause lots of problems throughout the world.
Yeah,
so
indeed.
It's not a one-way conveyor belt.
Well, so when you studied some of these species in Italy, were you able to ascertain whether they had changed physically coming here or thriving here?
That is a subject of study, not one that I've directly looked at. I was most interested in actually looking at a life phase of the spiny water flea. They have an interesting way of living. During the summer, they eat a lot and they simply clone themselves.
Really?
And then in the winter, just before winter comes, they finally have sex and lay an egg down at the bottom of the lake. And so each winter they deposit these eggs that are, for the most part, meant to allow them to survive winter. So much like a dormancy or a hibernation, they go to the bottom of the lake and hang out.
So these clones are having sex and producing?
Well, so they produce clonally during the summer, and then something happens in the autumn. Temperature drops, food resources decline, and a male will be produced. And so males and females pair just like they do in the human population, and they make this dormant egg. And so this egg should facilitate their ability to make it through winter when it's cold and there's not a lot of food. But those eggs also just get buried. And so we can go back in time, say back 10 years or 20 years or 50 years, and find those eggs and be able to do experiments on those eggs. So we can look at basically resurrect organisms that lived before I was born, you know, when my parents were young college students or my grandparents were, and resurrect those organisms and see what their behavior is like, what their physical features are like.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Megan Brown. She's a biologist at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Now you teach a course called Conservation Biology at HWS. Tell us what that means.
I do. So it's an upper-level course for students who have some background in biology. And I mainly teach this course through a local perspective, although it's an issue that's pervasive. Mm-hmm. But looking at sort of the biology behind conservation, what decisions and what information we need to know as we look at the landscape and try to pick places that we'd like to keep. And especially in modern times when those are rapidly changing by various environmental processes, that can be a very, very complex question. I've also had the opportunity to do that more globally with students. I've taken students to Lake Baikal in Siberia, where conservation is at the forefront of a lot of environmentalist minds, but not necessarily at the forefront of politics in that region. I also just returned from Australia and New Zealand with a group of students where, again, those very issues are confronting societies there. What spaces and what species do you conserve?
Yeah, that's a tug of war all over the globe, it seems.
It is.
At this point
it
in
is.
Time. Now, Hobart William Smith Colleges has an arm called the Finger Lakes Institute. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about it? I know you're an associate.
Sure. Yeah, the Finger Lakes Institute is situated on campus, and it has a number of people that are employed there and a number of faculty that are associated with it. And its mission is to understand the lakes through research, through education, and through economic vitality. So there's a whole variety of us involved that are far beyond the scientists that are interested in these types of questions. Mm-hmm. So they run a variety of programs. They do a program that's about ready to celebrate its 25th anniversary called Science on Seneca that is aimed at getting school teachers trained in limnology and specifically on Seneca Lake. And then they disseminate that to their students. So annually, I think it educates about 400 K-12 students.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And then you take students out on the lakes through this institute, too. Don't you do summer programs?
I do a fair amount of summer programs, and Hobart and William Smith Colleges also operates a research vessel that I take students out on quite regularly.
Oh, that must be fun.
It is, yeah. I think it's a highlight for many students to finally experience the lake on the lake instead of in the classroom. But I regularly have a lab of a few students that work with me throughout the summer.
Wow, that sounds like fun. I know it's a lot of work, but it still sounds like
fun. It is a lot of work. I like to tell the students that, you know, for every hour you're outside, that's about 3 hours in the lab. So it is fun to be out on the lake collecting data, but there's the other side, too.
Now, you also, I understand that you took some students out on some of the ponds right on campus and did some studies. Tell us about what you found and what you were looking for.
Yeah, there's a small piece of property actually that's somewhat remote from our campus that was donated to the colleges in the 1980s. And the former owner had established a number of man-made ponds on the property. So currently there's something like 40 small ponds on the property. which as an educator and a scientist is a gold mine to look at these systems that are essentially in the very same habitat. They experience the same climate. They experience the same runoff from nearby farms. But they've evolved in very different ways. And so some of them have fish. Some of them don't have fish. Some of them have beavers. Some of them do not. And we're particularly interested in two ponds, one that lacks a top predator fish, a fish that eats other fish, and the adjacent pond has one. And these two ponds are very different. In fact, to anyone, a small child, they would go out and tell you they're different. One is green and murky, the kind of pond you would not want to swim in.
And slimy, right?
Slimy, yeah. And the other one is crystal clear. You can see right to the bottom of it. You see the fish swimming and darting in it. And this is the result of that pond, that clear water pond, having a top predator in it that influences and kind of dominoes all the way down to the base of the food web, those green plants. And so it's been a great system to study, as I said, for my own research, but also one that's a really nice demonstration for students about the power of biology.
Wow, that's amazing. And so were those deliberately presented into the pond?
The former owner had deliberately stocked both ponds with probably the same assortment of fishes. And why it is that one, you know, went on to prosper and do well and the other didn't, we don't know the answer to that. And that's actually some potential investigation that will happen in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But for now, the very setting that it created is a really nice setup for biology.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating to me. Yeah. What are some of the most important attributes for somebody who wants to go into the sciences besides curiosity, obviously?
Yeah, that's a good one. In fact, I think that's probably the one that went right to the top of my mind is natural curiosity. One of the things I love about working with undergraduates is, you know, they're naive to the published literature, they're naive to the gurus in the field, but they have this curiosity that's really contagious, and they're asking questions that are really excellent questions to be asking. Organization and being detail-oriented is something I think many scientists have in common. The ability to look at a problem and simplify it down to a level at which you can test those drivers that you're interested in looking at. But being friends with a lot of scientists, we're all very different. We all approach the world in a different way. And I think that's probably what moves our fields forward, is that we do think independently. And we're all creating sort of a bigger answer to these smaller questions by looking at them with our different talents.
And you obviously have to have an open mind.
Yeah.
You don't come to research with preconceived notions, I would hope.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, we as scientists are certainly trained in different fields and what has come before us. But I think that's the real key in science, is when you get a surprise, that's when the really interesting things happen. Not when what you expect to have happen happens, but when things are a little different, and then digging deeper in to understand why that is.
Is it still the old adage that women are not going into the sciences as much?
Mm-hmm.
Women don't have as many opportunities, or is that changing as we speak?
There's a lot of effort to change it, but the statistics show that women continue to be underrepresented at the highest levels of the field. So by the time, I can give the example in ecology, graduates of PhDs in ecology are about 50-50. But the first jobs are dominated by men. The ability to get tenure is dominated by men. Full professors are dominated by men. And there's a variety of contributing factors there. Some of it is institutional. Others are occurring because of women choosing not to go on to those careers because of the climate that it creates or the constraints it creates on their own life.
Well, I've heard a lot of women are not encouraged in the lower grades to even take classes that would help them go on to the sciences. What was your experience? Were you encouraged?
I was definitely encouraged. I can say that one of the reasons I ended up as a biologist is because I had very influential biologists that were encouraging. Most of my In fact, all of them that come to mind at the moment were male, but they were all very nurturing and supportive in my decision. I had a professional mother who was definitely, she actually was a role model. And the only way I knew women to be, quite frankly, as a child, was through my mother's eyes, which was as a working professional. So I haven't felt a glass ceiling in my particular case, but I know that, you know, different women experience different things. And I can say that I've had some really excellent, positive role models in my life, and had those been a little different, biology might not have been the career I chose.
I want to ask you this too, as somebody who does research and comes up with conclusions, do some of your conclusions end up in the political arena? I mean, do you take some of these findings and say politically we've got to make changes because we're going to lose the lake, for instance? And how does that work?
To be honest, it's probably the last thing that I do. You know, I'm a teacher, I'm a scholar. Most of what I say and do goes either to my students, which are the vector to a lot of different places, or to professionals in my field through, you know, literature that goes out in scientific journals. And different people take that from there. Once a finding goes out, you know, someone else might capitalize on that and use it to pressure for, say, legislation and ballast water regulation or something like this. That isn't to say that I don't have a personal interest and don't make statements on occasion, but most of my time goes into teaching and to scholarship, and that's what I'm good at. And the political piece is sort of for someone else's talent for the most part.
And are you, like many of the scientists that I've talked to in recent years, worried about the climate in this country of anti-science, you know, things that we've proved and so on? Do you feel like you need to be a kind of a role model for making science continue to be relevant?
Sort of that science isn't accessible and asking, is that what you're asking?
And people scoff at scientific study even. You know, a lot of people say there's no such thing as climate change. And there is evidence that there is at least some, you know, even if people don't believe at all.
You know. I guess that we live in our own little bubbles a little bit. So I'm surrounded by scientists who are quite faithful in the science that they do. I think that, you know, the answer to that is that if you're doing good science and that you're working towards that, you know, ultimate goal, that science will continue to be something that, you know, is one of the legs of the stool, basically, that goes into decision making. I think that very often science can be inaccessible to people, that we've gotten to a point where, you know, any of us as scientists study fairly minute details. We're not always looking for the broadest brushstrokes. But that being said, I'm in a fairly applied area of science, and I'm in an area that many people are interested in. Exotic species are a huge hit on our economy. And so lots of people are interested in knowing the science that goes into that. You know, there's lots of examples in media, you know, just recently about invasive species. They're in there very regularly. And so I might feel that less as a scientist that's studying something else.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes left. Are there any new projects that you're working on that you could tell us about that we might hear about in the near future?
So one project that we're looking at right now that just got off and running this year is in Cayuga Lake, and looking at the southern end of the lake and water quality controls at the southern end of the lake. So that's a project that I'm involved in as a collaborator, but there's lots of folks in the area that are integrated in that. And it's a three-year project, so looking at what's happening down there and what critters are there and why are they doing their job or not doing their job. So that's off and running. I'm also, I mentioned earlier in the interview, looking at one of the newer invasive species in the Finger Lakes, this bloody red shrimp, which is in Seneca Lake. So far, not in any of the other lakes, but we'll be curious to see what the ecological impacts of that species are and whether fish are eating it, and if they're eating it, how is it that impacting other members of the food web.
Wow, that's great. Well, Megan Brown, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a delight talking to you about this.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it as well.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. We are a sponsored project of the Art Spire, a program of the New York Foundation for the Arts. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.